the bio, but just a little more color than...
Okay, I've done three things professionally. After serving in the United States Navy as an officer assigned to the Defense Intelligence Agency, I was a corporate executive for 15 years. First for a short time, two or three years with Booz Allen and Hamilton, where I took 146 plane rides the first year. After being promised it would be 50% travel, which of course was 100% for half the year and no travel for the second half of the year. That's 50%. But I enjoyed it a great deal and worked on multiple client experiences and had a very positive experience with Booz Allen. I became chief financial officer of, at the time, the largest financial institution in the state of Texas and probably the 20th largest in the United States at that time, Republic Bank of Dallas, at age 37. And that was a very active multi-bank holding company. So we did a number of acquisitions, a lot of financings here in the United States and abroad. So it was a growth company. Got to do a lot at an early age in that environment. After being a corporate executive in 1989, I set up a company. The company is Intersolve Group in Dallas, Texas. The business of Intersolve Group is executing the commercial agenda of chief executives, meaning we took responsibility for a result and our role was to lead and assemble the best available talent to execute. In fact, I have a patent on that label, just-in-time talent. And our clients were Fortune 100 companies and major entrepreneurs in the United States, Forbes 400 individuals, from whom I learned a great deal regarding talent, leadership, speed, good execution. While we didn't seek it, we gained a lot of recognition for producing compelling results. For example, we made $14 million in 90 days for a company in Los Angeles with four teams totaling 26 people from four different companies, only one of whom I'd ever met before, in changing business processes, the application of information technology, and managing human change. That one particular result was featured in a cover story in Business Week on the Virtual Corporation in the mid-90s. But the point is, when you bring the best available talent on demand, you can outcompete a lot of folks. And it is a great way to produce compelling results. So Tom Peters picked up on that, included us in these seminars and these books and newsletters on. You have to understand, this was before people used words like teaming, co-sourcing, outsourcing, virtual enterprise, partnering. Okay, we didn't know those words either. But I did learn from some of the most prominent entrepreneurs in the United States, large industrialists that own multiple companies, the value of leadership, best available talent, speed, and good execution. Which is a little different style than many corporate executives. So I had a great corporate experience, but I learned a lot and augmented that experience by being around entrepreneurs whose names you would recognize among the Forbes 400. So I did that for 14 years before getting a phone call inviting me to come to Washington. And so I've been honored to have two assignments. First is the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Agriculture, appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. Agriculture, if it were a private company, would be one of the largest in the United States. The ones that are materially larger would be Ford, General Motors, Exxon, and Walmart. So it's about the same size and diversity as a Citigroup or General Electric. 112,000 people. Invests $200 million a day, fights forest fires, protects food and water, the safety of food and water in time of war. So a very diversified enterprise. Unfortunately, it had no books. Had no records. Meaning I walked in just after 9/11. They said, we just closed our books. I said, very nice, let's look. We found 98,000 adjustments totaling $69 billion in just one line of business whose entire budget was $6 billion. Enterprise had no idea where $10 billion of property was. Roads, bridges, things that don't move in the night. Okay. Heroic missions.
Sure.
And some very important programmatic results. But from an operating standpoint, that was unauditable, as evidenced by never having a clean opinion, in fact having disclaimers on its opinion. So the assignment was to get sufficient internal control and accountability to merit a clean opinion. 1 year later, we had done that. It took 17 systems conversions, 10 of which we did in 1 year. It took reconciling 393 treasury symbols, which Don would describe as checking accounts, only half of which had ever been balanced. Understanding of well over $100 billion of cash flow. Understanding the present value cash flow on $100 billion of loans to farmers and rural development. So a number of things had to be done because it was an acute and chronic situation. And we did it. And it's been a sustained result. We got another cleanup in 2000. Now, the first one was 2002. They got one in 2003. I left. They've gotten them in 2004 and 2005. So we made progress in depth that stayed, that stuck. In that role, I also had responsibility for the National Finance Center, which is a large operations center in New Orleans. It manages the retirement plan for federal, civilian, and military employees. It administers the plan. So it's the record keeper on $150 billion of retirement assets for 3 million civilian and military personnel. It handles $26 billion of payroll by paying one-third of all federal employees, 550,000 people every 2 weeks. Its investments portfolio grows in excess of $1 billion a month. So I enjoyed those results, and in that case, I had just under 2,000 people working for me. I was really the only political. So the results were achieved by career civil servants, perhaps with a dose of hope and leadership that had not been there before. In 2004, really late 2003, I was asked to come to the Department of Education as Undersecretary and Chief Operating Officer of Education. In that role here, this enterprise, from an operating standpoint, is really a conduit or a financial services conduit with policy wrapped around it. We invest on behalf of students and children and the American taxpayer $140 billion a year of new money and guarantees to assure equal access to education, accountability in education, and international competitiveness. $60 billion of that $140 is formula and discretionary grants to states. Discretionary meaning a competitive grant, formula being based on population. And we invest $80 billion of federal student aid for the financing of higher education in loans, grants, and guarantees. That's 22 million customers in higher education, and a portfolio of $400 billion, which would be about 2.5 times the size of JPMorgan Chase. Chase's retail financial services book. We've also gotten good results here. Federal Student Aid have been a charter member of the government's high-risk list for 15 years. Recently, this year, 2005 was removed from that list. The results here that are most valuable in the time I've been here are with this massive customer base. That is, we're investing into a large customer base, states, districts, and that's where we have assured the effectiveness of those investments with large states like New York, California, large urban districts like the city of New York, individual grant recipients, for-profit schools. Along the way, we've issued the largest fine this enterprise ever issued, $9.8 million to one institution that got out of bounds. But the point is that, and the innovation is to have managed actively those investments, massive investments. That's almost $12 billion a month. That's $384 million a day of new money and guarantees. So that gives you some specifics. If you pull back from that a little bit, this administration has done an outstanding job in the operating effectiveness, improving the operating effectiveness of, let's just say, the 24 federal agencies on which a president's management agenda scorecard is kept and that have legislative statute requirements such as the Chief Financial Officers Act or the Chief Information Officers Act. It's hugely valuable. Hugely valuable. Don knows that we made $300 million in one day at the Department of Agriculture by taking loans that were not otherwise being collected that had been delinquent or defaulted, getting them collected. Well, that's $300 million, as much as $300 million every year for the foreseeable future. That would pay McKinsey, that would pay your three salaries and bonuses and maybe even give you some options as well.
Not bonuses.
It wouldn't cover the bonuses. Okay. So, let me stop there. I mean, that's sort of a quick rundown how I got here and what I was asked to do and what the results we've gotten. A lot of people come to Washington and they're interested in policy, politics, and press. Equally, if not more important, is the stewardship of public assets and effectiveness with the customer base. Any of these agencies have customer bases. And that's really where, as in the private sector, that's where the story is written. You can perfect all the policy you want, but without astute investments, you have not changed the reality for individual students, in our case, or customers, in someone else's case, the way we look at their customers. Or you haven't changed the reality of competitiveness. So, said another way, I mean, that's an affirmative way of looking at it from the reverse of that. In the public sector, you'll find more public officials who get into difficulty over the poor stewardship of public assets than they do policy disputes. Mm-hmm. It's like your own investments. More investment managers are fired over sloppy record keeping or messing up your trust records or whatever, than they are on poor investment performance. So it's extraordinary valuable work, and those who go about it do so in a very unassuming, quiet way, but it is extraordinarily valuable.
seems remarkable that you've been able to accomplish so much change in such a little amount of time. If there was somebody coming into a role like yours at another department, so a COO-like role, what would you advise them by saying, here are a couple surprising things I learned that you have to do if you're going to get this right?
Yeah. I found no barriers to producing results. And I don't mean that in an arrogant or egotistical way.
Sure.
I found no barriers. I do operate with about four principles that prove to be very solid in the public sector as they had in the private sector. One, I really do focus on results.
Can you give an example?
Process is important, but we are relentless on achieving results. There is more risk in not being bold enough than being too bold. As a federal official appointed by the President of the United States, confirmed by the Senate, in achieving results. So you really focus on the result, work backwards, figure the how to get it done. Okay. Number two, I act like an owner, and the people around me act as owners, and your experience is broad enough to know exactly what I'm talking about. In a bureaucracy, my experience is one of the keys to unlocking the natural strengths of a bureaucracy is individual accountability. You own it. I'm going to help you get it done, but you own it. That can make people a little uncomfortable until they have successes, and then they get more comfortable with it. But that's what I mean by clarity of ownership, clarity of accountability. Ownership. Three, I find it valuable to operate at a constructively aggressive pace. Speed is important, and you get better outcomes with shorter cycle times. So get to the essence of what needs to be done and cut the time it takes to execute. I don't mean in a chaotic sense. You know, if we said, let's go do that now, I and probably a couple of you would get up and go do it. Some people, you say, let's go do that now. It might happen this week, this month, this quarter, this fiscal year. So speed's important. And finally, I really do value leadership and talent. Now, that is my business.
Right.
But people are the only source of a sustainable competitive advantage. And so where I go after a breakthrough result, I do augment it with the best talent. For example, here or at Ag. Well, let's use Ag as an example. Within 10 days of being sworn in, I had four controllers from industry to augment the execution of the agenda, the business agenda I had set. Here, if we're going to do some data warehousing, I'll get the leading practitioner in the United States who has multiple repetitions and scale in data warehousing next to me. It's no different than if you're going to do an acquisition, you want the best acquisition attorney and the best investment banker. Okay. So that's what I mean. And there are lots of great people in the government. Don Hammond is one. If you're picking up sides to play a game down at the Sandlot, you know, in the old days, you guys are too young, but, you know, you throw the bat, you catch the bat, and whoever was the last one to hold the bat and be able to throw it a certain distance, got the first choice. Don Hammond would be one of the first choices. So, it's all very possible to do.
How do you augment the talent or motivate the talent within the career civil service? So, everyone has the opportunity to bring some in, as you did, but how do you quickly identify?
Well, you got three questions there. As far as augmentation, you have all the mechanisms available. Ranging from individual experts through 8A firms, boutique firms, conventional service firms, hiring of permanent SESers. And I've had, for example, I called a guy in Park City, Utah on Friday afternoon. I said, now is the time to serve your country. He was in my office Monday morning after finishing working on the Winter Olympics as an individual, American. Now, civil servant, career SESer. So that's the augmentation, how you get them involved. I meet with all the senior executives here once a month around a table, tell them what's important, listen to what they're interested in, because they are they're key owners. You know, political appointees come and go. It's just like seasonal help. It's Christmas help. But if you want things to sustain, you've got to get in depth. Okay. And then how you get them to really involved and successful, I think you just keep them focused on results. Everybody wants to be successful. They want to be known when they go to wherever they worship on the weekend, to be able to talk to their friends and associates about what they do. And if you help them, my job in a sentence is to make as many people as successful as I can, as fast as I can. And if I do that and the results speak for themselves, a lot of other things take care of themselves. I will say those that don't produce results catches up with them pretty quick, certainly in this administration, which as a taxpayer, I love that attitude. So,
is that true for individuals? I mean, it's certainly true. It's certainly true for agencies, the way OMB tries to manage agency performance. But do you find internally, when you're trying to motivate people to get on board and drive to results, those that aren't performing, do you have enough sanction available compared to, obviously you don't compare to the private sector, or do you find that actually there are ways to drive it?
Oh, I've terminated poor performers, and it is simply a matter of performance. Everyone has due process. It may take a little longer in the private sector, or if it's a private company where ownership. But no, I think there are plenty of ways to deal with poor performers. Just have to exercise them, whether they be career or political. So,
how do you think prevents? What do you think prevents more high performers or relatively high performers from exercising that? So I'll tell you what our perception is, having served, is that even high performers tend to, when it gets to that, you know, dealing with talent, they'll identify, move some around, but they won't really move on the poor performers. They view the process as too painful or other things, but I wonder if you motivate, you know, take the example of in New Orleans. Obviously, you got to move 2,000 people, and you're not going to be able to put in some political appointees that quickly. Presumably, not everyone was kind of rowing in the right direction. Or maybe that's not the right assumption.
Well, I mean, it starts with the leadership. Okay, you got to be a leader. Okay, you have to inspire people, and or make them your partner, whatever labels you all want to put on it. But in my style of doing that is to help make them successful with breakthrough results. Okay. I think one does that by the sale of intangibles and propositions. You get people to agree as to what's possible, see the possibility, see what the value is. And then if you do a few, you've got them. They'll follow you anywhere. At the National Finance Center, there were 250 people who did the accounting operations for the entire Department of Agriculture. People had spent tens, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars trying to get a clean opinion, trying to get internal control and accountability in this large enterprise. When it was done, I go back to those folks there, and I hand each one of them a piece of Lucite, like you would from Wall Street. Because you only get to do something like that the first time, one time. Mm-hmm. You only get the first clean audit one time.
Right.
And so, the question I got from around Washington when you make any of these breakthroughs is not how you did it, necessarily, but who are these people? Okay, who are these people? I use this line all the time of, George Barnard Shaw said, George Barnard Shaw said, all great innovation starts with an unreasonable person. Think about it. If it was reasonable, it's already been done. I'm just an unreasonable person. I look for unreasonable people. I see lots of them in government. I go every year, I've gone twice to the top floor of the State Department, where they recognize about 60 or 70 senior executives in the presidential distinguished rank awards. Individually at a black tie dinner in a room that's got $150 million worth of antiques in it. You want to see good performance from civil servants, just go there one time. You got a space shuttle commander. You got a woman who made what Stephen Hawking described as the most significant breakthrough in space science, so she's one of the top 50 scientists in America. You got the guy, or the lady, I forget who it was, found a source of power after 9/11 so the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the New York Stock Exchange could open within 3 days. And on and on and on. So if you're a political appointee and you don't differentiate yourself, you're just a person, you can do marvelous things, hugely valuable. Here we've created, I used this in a speech in Boston 2 weeks ago, we've created easily in excess of $25 billion of value just in the last few months alone, working in the scale of the kinds of investments I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So if you and your group, large or small, if you make incremental value in the federal government, you do something incrementally good, it's got a lot of value. You make a breakthrough, and it's huge. Think of it this way. If you're in the private sector and you got $1 billion net worth and a 10 multiple, you got $10 billion in market cap. Well, if you are the CEO and you make all the right acquisitions and keep overhead under control and grow your customers, and you get an 11 multiple, there's $1 billion of value. One literally can create $1 billion of value a week in the federal government. If you can see the value, take a little bit of an unorthodox, unconventional, atraditional approach to capturing that value.
Sorry, that's because the scale is so big.
Oh, yeah.
You're saying if you see an opportunity, the multiplier is so huge.
Sure. Yeah. Take loans in the federal government. The federal government's got a $1.5 trillion of loans and guarantees, principally in five federal agencies. Okay, if I put it in financial services terms, if I improve the spread or just to improve the collection rate, we work on defaulted student loans that accumulated in prior years. Tens of billions of dollars. Okay. We go get some private collectors and say to them, come work with us. I'll give you a couple $100 million to go work on for 60 days. After that, whatever you get to work on is dependent on your performance relative to my other collectors. Well, you like that if you're good. I like it because it aligns with the proper incentive. So there are all kinds of ways you can create value. But when you got scale, man. I'm talking principally about the large civilian agencies. You can do the same thing in defense. You can do the same thing in Homeland Security and some of the militarily oriented agencies as well. What else?
What are some of the things that you can do to get individuals to act like an owner? One of the things you described was give somebody a result that they're accountable for, but I'm sure it takes more than that.
I think one of the things is you can learn to trust them. If I say to you, you own this result, I trust you to get it done, that's an ultimate accountability. I'm going to help you when you want me to, and so forth. If you're astute, you're going to come to me when you need some help, or somebody else. So, if you can trust people, and believe in people, and I do. Not everybody does. When somebody violates that trust, they only do it one time. Okay? Because you can find out pretty quickly. But if you have these kinds of relationships, that's what is sustaining. It's the relationships with people that enable good leaders to get big things done over time. It's like my coaching friends say. Well, let me give you a little context. I play in one basketball game a year. It's an alumni game. It's coming up on February 4th. 20 guys will show up in a Division III school, Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. I'm the oldest by 30 or 35 years. We win every year. We don't play the varsity. We play the junior varsity. We've won the last 6 years. Each of those 6 years, I've managed to score one basket, which is enough to bring me back the next year.
That's the requirement.
To do that, I play 6 minutes. 3 minutes the first half, 3 minutes the second half. To do that takes me 180 days. To get ready. So it's 30 days a minute. Just so I'm going the right way on the basketball court when not everybody's going the other way. So people have to learn how to compete. And I don't mean compete to win every time, but compete to go beyond the comfortable and the familiar with the will and discipline to achieve a result. You with me?
I am.
That's my definition of a good competitor.
Mm-hmm. How do you teach that quickly? Because it seems to me that if you're looking for a very big change at scale in a short time, you have to do a lot of things pretty quickly. Develop scale, develop relationships with people, learn to trust them, give them the opportunity to fail. So I'm wondering, how do you do that in a way that you can...
Well, we talked about the principle. I gave you the four principles which I operate. My experience is, let's say when I was with as chief executive of Intersoft Group, when you assemble a talent, and in my case, those teams had extraordinary talent. But let's just say it's ordinary talent. And you're going to help make those people extraordinarily successful. Ordinary people extraordinarily successful. People rise to the challenge. It's that clarity and confidence that they have in the leader. I think that's, you got to be able to, if you can see around the corner, people use the word vision, I use the word foresight. If you can see around the corner, and if you can see what's possible, and you can encapsulate that result, or make that proposition to in an inspiring way, and then show success, I mean, it's not complicated. But you got to have a lot of repetitions in it. I think where people acquire that, leaders acquire that, is in demanding situations. Meaning, let's just start with some of the traditional bridges from your college experience. You go in the service, and that's a classical place to get a lot of demanding experiences. If you are with active corporations, and you're asked to stand in boardrooms at a young age and brief board members, or do stand in Skinner Hall and do financing in euro dollars of $150 million at 08 over LIBOR for 12 years as a single A company, and that beats a double A rated company. If you set up a firm that's got demanding clients, you've got demanding clients. I have very demanding clients. That makes service firms generally, and people who provide services and do things and play and run with the big dogs, makes you better. So not everybody wants to do that, but you get multiple repetitions over a long period of time, a lot of other things are easy. If you have some real challenges in your life, in whatever form, and you deal with them successfully, it makes a lot of other things easy. We have friends that are got their children now in special forces or SEALs, and these men, in some cases women, they're less than 30 years old, or they're flying a plane. You do that a couple tours of duty, and it makes a lot of other things easy. So it's all sort of relative to what your context is. And I'm not advocating everybody seek that, but those that do. And I think a lot of people look for those things. They want to, people today, you know, everybody's a free agent, okay, so they don't want a slot on an organization chart. You're probably at McKinsey not because you got some title or some slot. You're there because you're in a cluster of people that you can trust and they're capable and so forth. So that's what people want. They just want to be around good leaders.
I think a lot of people, certainly in the private sector, would be very surprised to hear you, first of all, use a lot of what I would call private sector language, customers, results, etc. And the fact that you say you've come to Washington and have had no barriers, really, to bringing those principles to bear. A lot of people would find that, I think, surprising. They would assume that there would be significant barriers. Do you see no barriers now because you've been doing it for 4 or 5 years? Did you see barriers when you first came in? Do you genuinely believe there's no barriers in applying most of those principles?
No, don't misunderstand. I'm not in an arrogant or egotistical way, but I do believe in possibilities. I look at what's possible and how can I create huge value with less risk. Risk and reward go together. Mm-hmm. But there are ways to create huge rewards with disproportionately lower risk.
You're saying in government it's easier to do it with
either
less risk?
In government or in private sector.
Sorry,
but when I came to government, I mean, I'd never been politically active. I've never been in government, with the exception of military service a long time ago. And I listened carefully to what the White House staff wanted to get done when they talked to me. Now maybe I didn't worry about all the reasons it couldn't get done. You know, maybe I should have.
what is
probably
high risk?
Not. It's better now.
When you say it's interesting, you say huge value, low risk, and that's in tandem with what you said earlier about, you know, quietly, unassumingly, just getting stuff done with big prizes but low risk. What for you is areas of high risk? What are the things you avoid?
Well, understand, our job is not to eliminate risk. Okay, if we otherwise we would never make an innovative grant or a student loan. But our job is to manage risk, and by that I mean vulnerabilities, exposures. You can find industries in which the government participates that are permeable and porous businesses. Let's just take education. Education is a $1 trillion industry in the United States. 500 billion kindergarten through 12th, and 500 billion higher education. Lots of great schools, lots of great teachers, principals, business officials. On the other hand, in a porous and permeable industry, you have a lot of opportunity to create value. Turn that on. I'll just give you some context. We'll just turn it off for a minute.